Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Mary Cummings Jordan. Philadelphia's planned safe injection site will not be opening this week after all. Safe House is the nonprofit that was set to open a facility in South Philadelphia after a federal judge cleared the way last fall. It would have been the nation's first supervised injection site, but plans are now on hold after a community uproar and accusations of bait and switch. Philadelphia has seen more than 3,000 fatal drug overdoses in 3 years. And WHYY's Nina Feldman has been covering the story. She joins us now with the latest. Nina, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what exactly happened over those few days to cause Safe House to hit the pause button on plans to open in South Philly?
Right. So the first thing that happened was, you're absolutely right, last fall is when the federal judge sort of issued his decision that made it clear that this was going to be able to happen. He ruled that a supervised injection site would not violate federal law. It would not violate the Controlled Substances Act. But it wasn't just based on some technicalities of the court case. It wasn't a final decision that would allow the site to open. So that final ruling was issued last week. Safe House, the nonprofit, its leaders jumped into action and quickly announced right after the judge announced his decision that they were going to open right away. They've always said that. They've always said they were going to open as soon as they had the legal authority to do so. I think what surprised people about their announcement was where they said they were going to open, which was in South Philly as a first location instead of in Kensington, where everybody sort of assumed the first site would go. That's the heart of the opioid epidemic in the city. There are more overdose deaths in that neighborhood than in any other. And neighbors in South Philadelphia who had sort of, to be honest, probably not been following this quite as closely because they just assumed this would happen further down the line here, if it happened at all, reacted with outrage. Yeah. And they felt really, really blindsided.
So why South Philly then? Because Kensington would have seemed the logical choice if that's the epicenter of the epidemic. South Philly's nowhere near there.
That's right. But there are a lot of overdose deaths in South Philly. And in Kensington, where you see essentially an open-air drug market and you see a lot of people experiencing homelessness and you see a lot of public injection, that's not really the scene in South Philadelphia. You have more people overdosing behind closed doors, in homes. It's a different sort of culture of drug use there. But it's the second highest rate of overdoses of any neighborhood in Philadelphia. So it's a huge problem there as well.
And we should mention, too, that the landlord, if you will, also pulled out of this.
That's right. So there was all this community blowback, and Safe House's organizers and board members said, okay, we got to take a pause. There's so much pressure on us from city council, from local politicians, from the community. We are going to take a step back and have some community conversations. But essentially, their announcement or decision to do that came too late, and the landlord of the building that they were going to open in South Philadelphia responded to that pressure as well from the neighbors and decided that he wanted to back out of the lease.
And where would it have been?
It would have been in the Constitution Health Plaza, which is at the corner of Broad and McKean in South Philadelphia, right near Broad and Snyder. There's a Broad Street Line stop there. There are a couple other health facilities in that building. So there's a Penn Urgent Care Center. There's a, you know, some offices for the Philadelphia Health Department. There's some other recovery resources. And notably, there also is a daycare there, which a lot of the neighbors were pretty upset about, that there would be, you know, a lot of people using drugs in close proximity to children.
Yeah. You've spent a lot of time in the neighborhood covering the story. Sketch a picture for us of what the neighborhood's like.
So, I mean, it's a lot of people who have lived there for a long time, who have for generations been South Philadelphians and been prideful of that. And, you know, I went yesterday to this rally or protest sort of opposing the site in its original location, even though that's already, the plans for that have been canceled, but, you know, sort of opposing any site in the neighborhood. And you had a lot of people who were really sort of using their South Philadelphia identity, galvanizing that and saying, you know, we're united, we're not going to let this come to our neighborhood because that's not what this neighborhood stands for.
It seemed remarkable to me, Nina, the way that neighbors organized and the quickness with which they organized. I mean, things got really contentious over a couple of days. Take us back to last week and describe how neighbors sort of galvanized around this.
Yeah, a lot of it happened on social media. There were Facebook groups. A lot of people got upset. And then I think one of the ways in to really cause, to be able to influence this decision was to go to the building and talk to the other tenants in that building and say, hey, do you know what's planned for this building? And that's what neighbors did. And I think that was sort of where ultimately the most change was made, because if a landlord isn't going to offer space anymore, then you have to sort of go back to the drawing board. So yeah, that was a sort of intentional community organizing tactic to say, how can we stop this? Yeah. What's the most direct line to stop this from happening? And you go to the building for that.
Yeah. And there was a news conference as well that got pretty heated, it sounded like.
Yeah. Tempers certainly flared. And again, I think that was because people felt like there was no community process. And in a lot of neighborhoods in Philadelphia, if you want to put a deck on your house, you have to have a community meeting. And, you know, here was something that people felt was going to have a real impact on the neighborhood, and nobody told them about it.
So what exactly would have been happening at Safe House? What services do they offer? What would happen in there?
Yeah, I do think it's important to mention that and make it clear, because there is a lot of misinformation flying around. So supervised injection facilities operate all over the country. They're in Canada, they're in Europe, and they are essentially medical clinics. Somebody can walk in with their own drug supply, so there are no drugs provided by the facility, bring them in and inject under medical supervision. So there'll be a doctor or a nurse standing by with the overdose reversal drug naloxone or Narcan. In case somebody does overdose, there's somebody there to revive them. And Safe House has also said it plans to have, you know, access to recovery services, so that if somebody is going to use drugs there and then one day decides, you know, I'm ready to start on medication-assisted treatment like methadone or buprenorphine, that will be available for them. And they'll also have, you know, clean syringe services and wound care for some of the infections that are sort of ancillary products of injection drug use.
So what's the argument? Because people will say, look, if you want to help people who are struggling with addiction, allowing them to shoot up supervised is not the answer. What is the argument for doing it that way?
The harm reduction argument from that sort of perspective is essentially, these are folks who are in deep addiction, and they are going to be injecting drugs one way or another. That's not that their brain has been rewired at this point where this is how they're behaving, and that behavior in this moment is not something that's going to change. So the best thing you can do from a sort of public health perspective is make sure somebody doesn't die. And so that's why you have somebody who is there watching somebody to make sure that they don't overdose. I think, you know, when you look at the research at supervised injection sites all over the country, or excuse me, all over the world, what you see is that they have been shown to reduce overdose deaths. That, you know, in the immediate proximity of the where the sites are located. That's what they do. And I think, you know, you have people say, well, this isn't going to reduce opioid use, you know, across the board. And you would have a researcher might respond to that and say, well, no, that's not what we purport to do with a site like this. It has a very narrow, specific purpose, which is, as the nonprofit Safe House, you know, directors would say, its purpose is saving lives, and that's what it's there for.
So it's not so much reducing the use, it's reducing the deaths.
Yeah,
is the
exactly.
Argument. What about the concerns about crime? Because you mentioned that there are these kinds of sites in Canada and other countries. One of the concerns that neighbors had was, look, beyond allowing people to shoot up in this building, what about everything that comes with that? We're concerned about an increase in crime and all of the other things that come along with that.
Yeah, that is a real concern. At the protest yesterday, I talked to one woman she said her cousin is in active addiction, and she said she asked her cousin, you know, what, you know, would you use this? And her cousin said, yeah, I would use it. I think it would make it easier for me to score drugs if this were here. It would, you know, bring dealers around and it would be more convenient. I mean, she just told her that. Yeah. So I think there is that fear, and a lot of people call it the honeypot effect, that it would sort of bring more drug use and sort of the economy of drug sales to the area. There has been research that shows that that doesn't actually happen when these sites go into neighborhoods, but it is definitely a fear that people that people have. Crime in general, again, I think the research shows that supervised injection sites don't have much impact on crime one way or another. It doesn't make it worse, but it also doesn't make it better. You know, again, it's not this silver bullet that is going to say, you know, once this comes, crime will dissipate. And somebody who advocates for a site like this would say, and it's not supposed to. It's a public health measure. It's not a crime measure. Would you expect crime to go down if you put a hospital in a neighborhood? Probably not. You know, that's not what it's there for. Yeah. So I think that's something that people definitely are concerned about, and there's some research on it, but it would sort of be a to be determined sort of wait and see.
It sounds like there is unified government opposition to this as well, starting from the U.S. attorney all the way down.
Yeah, that's right. So on the federal level, U.S. Attorney William McSwain is still fighting in court. That federal judge issued his ruling, but McSwain is appealing, and he has really made this a personal issue. He is going after it hard. If his appeal is, you know, denied, I think he has said he would find other ways to try to approach this. And then, yeah, locally, you have state legislators who are introducing bills that would require certain public processes for local municipalities to open up sites like these. And then on a city level, last week you had, during city council, pretty much everybody speak out against this site, with a few exceptions. Everybody said the way this happened was inappropriate and, you know, warned against, if it starts in this neighborhood, that might mean that it's coming to my district soon and I won't be having that. Councilman Kenyatta Johnson, whose district it is in, basically said he's going to fight tooth and nail to make sure a site like this does not come to his district. So you had a lot of opposition there as well. The one administrator who, you know, local official who has remained in favor is the mayor. He supports the site and he supports the site's organizers. So he's in the minority there. But again, he hasn't done much to facilitate its opening. He has just sort of stood in unity with the site's organizers.
So in our last few seconds here, Nina, what's next for Safe House now that they've had to put a halt to their plans?
Yeah, I think they need a little time to go back to the drawing board and regroup and figure out what's next. They need to find a new space. I don't know if that's going to be in South Philly as a first stop or somewhere else, but I think more broadly they're going to have some tough conversations with the neighborhood and regain some trust.
WHYY's Nina Feldman, thanks so much for being with us. When Radio Times comes right back, we'll talk about the surprising number of college students who are struggling with food and housing insecurity. Stay with us. And welcome back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
To the Radio Times Regional Roundup, I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Mary Cummings Jordan. College students across the United States are facing a challenge that goes well beyond keeping their grades up and balancing their extracurriculars. It's a challenge that threatens not only today's students, but tomorrow's workforce. We're talking about food and housing insecurity, and it is a bigger problem than you might think. Researchers at Temple University have been tracking this problem for the past 5 years through the Real College survey of students in 44 states and the District of Columbia. Temple sociology professor Sarah Goldrick-Rabb is the head of the university's Hope Center for College, Community, and Justice. Her book is Paying the Price, College Costs, Financial Aid, and the Betrayal of the American Dream. She joins us now with more about the survey and what it tells us about the difficulties that some college students are facing. And before we get into our conversation, let me invite our listeners to join us as well. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, or of course you can always call 888-477-9499. That said, Sarah Goldrick-Rabb, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So what is the Real College Survey? What does it measure exactly?
The Real College Survey is an instrument that's trying to get a look at what's actually happening for students these days. There are so many stereotypes of who a student is in college. We hear about them going off to college, basically still getting an allowance from their parents, living on campus, partying, and if they fall asleep in class, it's because they stayed up too late talking to their friends. We've begun to understand that that really is an outdated stereotype. Most people don't realize that only 15% of American college students even live on a college campus. Wow. Even the people who are young-ish, might be 20 years old, are very much on their own financially. And many of them are facing prices for college that honestly, even with work and financial aid, leave them without enough for the basics. So we started doing the survey many years ago. It wasn't just about food and housing. It was just, what does life look like? How do you make it work?
Yeah. And those are interesting questions that probably had not been asked previously.
That's right. They hadn't been asked. And one of the reasons that we did measure things like food and housing is because even though the federal government has surveyed college students for 40 years, they don't ask any of these questions. So we know things like, you know, students these days might not study as much, or they might not go to office hours as much, but we really don't know why. Yeah. And these kinds of questions, they start to unpeel that onion a bit.
So what did you find out?
So, you know, starting about 5 years ago, we really did start to see evidence that students did not have their basics met. You know, things like if you're in an elementary school classroom and you watch a child fall asleep in class, it is reasonable to wonder, you know, were they unable to get a good night's sleep? Are things okay at home? Right? As I said before, it's normal for a faculty member to just wonder, do you really care about college? When we started to do this survey, we started to see that students legitimately do not have sufficient access to affordable food to eat every meal that you're supposed to. And they don't always have a safe and secure place to live. And so year after year, the sample has grown. The only way we can ask these questions of students is if their colleges let us. And that's a big deal. So most of the students who haven't done these surveys, it's because the college hasn't participated. When they do participate, we see very, very high rates of these problems. At least a third of students at public four-year institutions deal with food insecurity, and upwards of 40 to 50% of community college students are also not getting affordable, sufficient access to food so they can eat every day.
So that's huge. So you said almost a third of four-year college mm-hmm. students that responded to this mm-hmm. survey have some form of food insecurity, and 40 to 50% in community college. That is staggering.
It is. And you know, the first survey that we did, it was 10 colleges in seven states, and it was 4,300 students. We now have, we've been very persistent, we now have data from over 400 colleges and universities and over 330,000 students. And the results have really not changed.
Wow. And so 400 is about what percentage of the colleges in the United States?
It's honestly, it's about 10%. Most people don't realize that while we talk about like 25 or 50 of all the colleges in this country over and over, there are over 4,000. The colleges that are not doing this are first and foremost the for-profit colleges. That honestly, I don't know why they would want to participate because they're just working on attracting students and unfortunately, they're in debt. A lot of the private colleges, you know, places that, you know, in this city, places like Penn, they don't tend to participate in these surveys. They might do their own and just not share the data, but for whatever reason. We mainly have data, number one, from the public four-year universities. Places like Temple are participating. Mm-hmm. And a lot of community colleges, you know, I'd say we've made a significant dent, especially in places where the community college plays a huge role, like California, New York, Chicago, Arizona, Texas. We have tons of community colleges from across the country.
Probably a good time to define our terms mm-hmm. and talk about what exactly we mean when we say food insecurity and housing insecurity versus homelessness. So what does all of that mean?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, when we say food insecurity, they think, well, kids these days just don't want to eat ramen. And that's not what's happening. Okay, the United States Department of Agriculture recognized a while ago that if we were trying to figure out if someone gets enough food, we can't just say, are you hungry? It's because if you don't get enough to eat regularly, you won't always even admit that you're hungry anymore. You won't even feel it. This is about a condition of not having enough money so that you can't eat enough food to actually be okay. Yeah. So it can mean that you're cutting the size of your meals, skipping meals. It can mean you're losing weight, but by the way, it can also mean you're gaining weight. Food insecurity in America is associated with obesity. Housing insecurity can mean a lot of things. Oftentimes what it means is you're really on the brink. It can mean that you're really struggling to pay your rent on time. You're asking your landlord for extensions. You're not paying your utility bills. These things can lead to homelessness, but they're often like a step or two from that. Then there's homelessness. We follow the U.S. Department of Education's definition, which is used in K-12 schools all over the country. It says, look, if you do not have a secure and reliable, safe place to sleep, you're homeless. A lot of times that means couch surfing. And couch surfing, again, people think college students, oh, that sounds like fun.
That's what they do.
Right. They're hanging with their friends. No, what this looks like is I have nowhere to go. So I have to really lean on somebody and ask, can I stay with you for a week? Then can I stay with somebody else for a week? And these students are spending a lot of time worrying about where they're going to be next. And they're not in their own homes. So some of them can't use the refrigerator. They can't use the shower. They have no place to actually keep their laptop or to do any studying. They're just moving around constantly. And some of them sleep in their cars. A tiny number of them sleep in shelters. But this is legitimate homelessness.
And making it all the harder then to focus and concentrate on getting something done in school if you don't even know where you're sleeping tonight or where your next meal's coming
That's
from.
That's right. I mean, the surveys are also clear that these students, they know why they're in college. It's not like they're wandering aimlessly. They have academic plans. They have intentions. They actually do study. They do come to class. They have a lot less energy when they're there, right? And they are more likely to be sleep deprived. And we all know what that's like. You know, the professor's in the front of the room talking about chemistry, and you're just thinking, where's my next meal coming from? Or how am I going to pay my rent?
Yeah. So what did you find in terms of the homelessness and the housing insecurity piece? We talked about the food insecurity, but what did you learn about housing insecurity and homelessness?
So the rates of housing insecurity are actually now higher than the rates of food insecurity.
Wow.
So this year, we saw those climb above 40%. Nationally, for the community college students, it's even a little higher. In some parts of the country, it can approach 50 to 60%. And, you know, we shouldn't be surprised because there's a national affordable housing crisis. And because while there are programs like low-income energy assistance programs, you know, here in Philadelphia, PICO has one, they're not really advertised to college students. So we shouldn't be surprised. And with regard to homelessness, the numbers this year are about 17% for community college students have experienced it over the last year, and 16% for the four-year college students. This doesn't mean they're homeless every day. Just like anything else, some homelessness is very persistent and chronic and happens all the time. And some of it is episodic. But the thing is, the research shows that even one short-term episode of homelessness is traumatic and can derail your odds of getting a college degree.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. Sarah, by your own admission, most students who receive the survey do not respond. So based on that, then how do you know how accurate your results are?
Yeah, I mean, listen, as a scientist, no scientist is like, yay, I got 10 or 20% response rates. This is terrific. It's abysmal. It's also, unfortunately, a fact that we have basically no money to do this work. So we can't pay students to answer surveys, and no one in America is doing surveys electronically right now that they're not paid to do. So we had to ask the question, who isn't answering versus who is, right? If every homeless student who got the survey was like, yes, I'm going to do a survey, then we're overstating things. But the stronger likelihood is that if a student doesn't even have a safe and reliable place to sleep, they're not getting their email. They're not even opening the email. And if they are, this survey is not pitched as about any of this stuff. It doesn't even mention housing or food in the invitation. It offers them no support. So there really isn't any reason to believe that they're jumping at the chance. Rather, our interview suggests that most of the people who we do identify through teachers, through staff, etc., have never received our surveys. If that's true, then we're understating things.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that if you're getting that kind of a response from a small number of students who are responding, then the numbers are probably bigger than what they look.
They probably are, but I'll also tell you, one of the things we've done is every day since 2015 when we started this, we have petitioned the federal government persistently to start collecting this data. They have tens of millions of dollars to do their surveys. We don't even have hundreds of thousands. So this year, they finally agreed. It took 5 years. This fall, they're putting this on their annual survey. The problem is twofold. Number one, we won't get the data until 2022. So we won't get national estimates till then. Secondly, they do not disaggregate by state or college. So no college president can actually look and say, this is my data. These are my students. And when we talk about action to help students, that specificity has been really important for getting administrators to pay attention.
Speaking of action to help students, so now that you've got this information or at least some sense of what the problem is, what happens now? How do you address it?
That's the question that we've really been asking. And the thing is that the Real College movement has moved from just a survey to an annual conference where people get together and make plans, and frankly, to a whole set of technical assistance work that our team at the Hope Center for College Community and Justice and other partners are doing to help colleges become what we call student ready, which means you cannot just suggest that because a student got into college that their basic needs are met. You have to get ready to be able to support them. And this is a time when most of higher education has less money to support students on a per-student basis. So it means bridging to community partners. It means figuring out how the local food bank can help you. It also means taking advantage of programs like SNAP, the food stamp program, which very few people recognize is a college completion program.
Really?
Yes. Employers need to get that if they want workers who have learned in school and graduated, they need to not only help them get access to good work while they're in college, they need to support the SNAP program and the financial aid programs so that students don't drop out with debt and no degree. It's not productive. We also need colleges to have more emergency aid programs so they can fill in where financial aid fails. And we need to be able to provide affordable housing to students. Right now, a lot of students are taken advantage of with really outpriced housing that seems to exploit the fact that they need to live near campus. Instead, we should be saying we need to keep college as affordable as possible for folks so that they don't have to max their loans and so that they don't drop out of school because they can't pay their bills. Yeah.
Well, I know Democratic candidates are talking a lot about that, and I want to ask you that in a moment. But first, we have an email question here from Tim, who asks, can students who are struggling to afford college just take a break from school and work?
You know, I've thought about that a lot. The answer is, of course they could, and I think in some ways it's easier. It is easier when you're in distress to not also be trying to buy your books and go to school every day. But you have to remember, 90% of these students are already working or actively seeking work. You also have to remember that what tends to happen is they will stop out. They will get low-wage, dead-end employment. They will not be able to save much. We know the situation of those workers right now. They never find their way back. And so while I have seen students do that, they become former students. Also, if they have taken loans, even $500 of loans, the minute that they stop out, those loans start to have to be repaid. And these people don't have any ability to do that. And they scramble even with programs like income-based repayment in place.
Yeah, and there's no getting out of those loans once
you take
them.
No, there's not. There's not.
Yeah. So I was saying that the Democratic candidates, several of them, are talking about free college tuition and eradicating student debt. How realistic are proposals like that in your view?
Look, I mean, first of all, we can only do things we set out to do. So the talk is important, and it's important that we're recognizing that today's financial aid system is horribly broken. Some of the plans out there have much more specificity and detail to them. They're not two paragraphs. They're long. And some of them are accompanied by additional bills and drafts of things to address things like food insecurity. When the candidate has more than one way to get this done and a set of proposals, it seems to me that's a signal that that person actually stands a chance of getting something passed. At this moment, Congress has pending 6 different pieces of legislation to address campus food insecurity and several others that would address housing insecurity and homelessness. What we need them to do is take it seriously and begin to move it forward.
Talk about the workforce, Sarah, and what all of this means potentially for the workforce down the line.
It has a lot of implications. I've never met an employer who didn't say, I want students to think critically and have good writing skills, and I want a diverse workforce. You cannot become a student with critical thinking skills and good writing skills if you cannot focus on school. And you cannot spend the time learning rather than worrying. So you're going to see the populations, the diverse populations you most want to hire, are going to be the least likely to get degrees. And everyone, I don't care what their race, ethnicity is, or whether they're the first in the family to attend college, when they go through this in college, even if they get a degree, they graduate less healthy and therefore less able to be the effective employee that we want. Yeah. So I think that we are really missing the boat in focusing so much on just telling students what to major in, for example, or telling them to go to college faster. If you make their basic needs easier to meet, all of the rest will fall into place.
I noticed that schools are now opening food pantries. That was quite surprising to me when I first heard about it, maybe 2 years or so ago. Is that a fairly common thing now that you're beginning to see?
It's a trend. There's a College and University Food Bank Alliance. It now has more than 800 members. The thing is, in this country, and there's a wonderful book about this called Sweet Charity, we have a tendency, when we're told about hunger, we have a tendency to lean towards charity. And what we do is we stock food banks and food pantries. The problem is that that provides emergency food assistance in small amounts to individuals, and it never addresses the systemic problem. So it doesn't actually reduce food insecurity, and it doesn't prevent it. We have to go beyond that to expand access to things like SNAP.
Yeah. Fascinating conversation. Really opened our eyes, Sarah, to what is happening with our college students. I think many of us did not realize it. Sarah Goldrick-Rabb is a professor at Temple University. Radio Time's Regional Roundup will be back in just a moment. And welcome back to the radio.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Radio Time's Regional Roundup. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Mary Cummings Jordan. She is a longtime advocate for the LGBTQ community, and as of today, Selena Morrison is the new executive director of Philadelphia's Office of LGBT Affairs. In her new position, Morrison will advise city leaders on policy and be the leading voice for LGBTQ people in city government. She replaces Amber Hikes, who resigned last summer to take a job with the American Civil Liberties Union. Selena Morrison joins us in studio to talk about what she hopes to accomplish in her new role. Selena, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being here on your very first day on the job. We're honored that part of your first day includes a stop here at WHYY.
Absolutely. It's exciting. I'm glad to be here.
So we have been hearing the Democratic presidential candidates talking about what they would do on day one if they win the election. What are your plans for day one?
Well, I know I'm going to be doing a lot of administrative stuff. You know, there's some onboarding that needs to happen. I'm going to be having some meetings with some of the top administrators that I'm going to be working with. And that's pretty much it.
Well, that'll be enough for the first day.
Yeah, sure. That's enough.
The Philadelphia Inquirer describes you as the first openly trans-identifying person to lead the city's LGBT office. And as far as anyone knows, the first openly trans person to head any city office or department. That feels really significant.
Yeah, I knew none of that going in, but I think it's exciting. But honestly, I believe it's more, it's not just about me, you know. This role is more about representing the entire community. But I do think it's exciting, and it's, you know, about breaking down barriers.
Yeah. So what are your goals for the community, and what do you want to accomplish in this position?
Well, one thing I really want to do is kind of like get hold of where things are that are already in the process. The things that Amber did, I want to continue to work on some of the things like that she had started when she was in office. That's one of the main things I want to do before I dive into anything new, because there are a lot of things that our community needs. Yeah, I wanted to get a hold on what she started before.
Well, you mentioned Amber Hikes, and those are big shoes to fill, for sure.
Absolutely.
She is known nationally for her activism on behalf of the LGBTQ community. She's also known for adding the black and brown stripes to the city's pride flag to represent LGBTQ people of color. So do you see yourself kind of continuing what she started, and maybe how might your tenure look different from hers?
Well, I do think my tenure would probably look different. We are two different folks, and we have, I'm sure, two different perspectives. But what I do think is the same is the needs of our community. And, mm-hmm. you know, one thing I know, however, there is one annual event that I know will continue, and that's the LGBTQ State of the Union. I would love to continue that that program that she started. So yeah. It's really important.
Let me invite our listeners to join us in our conversation. You mm-hmm. can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at @WHYY Radio Times, or you can call us at 888-477-9499. We're talking with Selena Morrison. This is day one for her in her new position as executive director of the city's Office of LGBT Affairs. Selena, what would you say are the most pressing issues for the LGBTQ community in Philadelphia right now?
Well, I think access to health care is one, job discrimination, housing discrimination, homelessness is a huge issue in our community.
Really?
I think there are far too many young folks in our community that are spending every single day in survival mode.
You mentioned healthcare, and I'm interested to follow up on that. Why is that such a big concern?
I think it's a lot of the stigma that around many of the issues that the folks in our community are facing.
Yeah. And what about nationally? The Trump administration's policies have been regarded as harmful mm-hmm. to the LGBTQ community. What are you most concerned about on the national level, and how might you advocate for change there?
Well, I think the treatment of the LGBT community by the Trump administration is more than frustrating. I do tread lightly around those issues, but I can say that it does frustrate me, and there is a lot of work to be done. And I believe that the start of that work starts within the city, and we bind together as we make progress yeah. and do what we can on a city level.
You say you tread lightly around those issues. Why?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Why is that?
Because I don't want to speak out of turn. This is my first day. So, you know.
One step at a time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Got to dip your toe in the water
yes,
first, right?
Absolutely.
You've been quoted as saying that you take an intersectional approach to your work. What do you mean by that?
Taking an intersectional approach is really about taking a look at all of the issues that are facing our community and how they overlap. And when we speak of that, a person may be a person of color and trans identified and handicapped. The things mm-hmm. that person face is going to be different than someone who is, you know, physically able-bodied and a gay white male, yeah. you know, not to say that a gay white male doesn't have, you know, issues that they're facing, because they do, but they're going to be two different types of issues, and there's going to need to be different types of approaches to deal with those issues.
Yeah. So kind of multi-layered
Absolutely.
Issues, right?
Absolutely.
You are originally from North Carolina,
yes.
I understand.
Yes.
What brought you to Philly?
Well, family. I was looking to make some changes in my life. As we all know, the South is a difficult place to flourish as a trans-identified person. So I needed to be in a more progressive city, and Philadelphia is just that.
How did you get involved in advocacy?
Well, I got to the age where I really just felt like I had overcome some of the barriers that were, you know, in the trials that I had faced. And I felt like, you know, I'm still going through those things, and I'm still learning, and I'm still making mistakes. And I think that's one of the reasons why I think I'm going to do good in this position, because I've experienced a lot of the things that our community is going through. And I got to a point to where I wanted to give back and start to help others that may have be facing some of those same things.
Speaking of that, you said, and I'm quoting here, as a Black trans woman, I've experienced firsthand the transphobia, workplace discrimination, many other challenges that face the LGBTQ community. Can you talk a little bit more about some of the challenges that you have faced personally and how they will inform your work in this position?
Yeah, I think it's important. You know, one thing I always remind folks is that it's difficult for someone who has lived through those things to continuously relive that trauma. But for some of us, it's important for us to use that trauma and that life experience that we've had to understand where the folks in our community are coming from. Mm-hmm. And I think having that experience and living through that experience, I can reach them and communicate with them on a totally different level and a personal level, and understand what their needs are when I'm working with city government.
Yeah. Speaking of city government, I was reading that the Philadelphia Police Department just graduated its first openly transgender police officer. And last summer, the police department announced new policies for interacting with trans and non-binary people, including changing terminologies, referring to them by their preferred name, if it's different
Absolutely.
From their legal name, that sort of thing. Has the department done enough to consider the needs of trans people in the city, and is there more to be done?
Yes, I think the city is doing more than enough compared to some of the other places mm-hmm. that I've lived. But I think there's always going to be work to be done. The community is constantly changing. The needs of the community are constantly changing. But I think Philadelphia has done a great job mm-hmm. at providing as much of what, you know, they can do. But I think that there is still work to be done. Also, I wanted to add that I think it's exciting that we have a trans-identified police officer. I have not had the opportunity to meet them, but I think it's exciting and brave, and I'm happy to hear about it. That's one of the things that I look forward to working on, is the relationship between the LGBT community and the Philadelphia Police Department.
Selena, what would you like to see when you talk about more work that needs to be done? And I just mentioned a couple of things that the police mm-hmm. department has done since last summer to sort of be more sensitive, right, to the needs of the community. What are the things that you want the people of Philadelphia to know, to be sensitive to be aware of, to put into practice as it relates to the LGBTQ community?
I think it's important to realize that when you're dealing with folks in the LGBT community, that, like I mentioned before, that they are a community of people, and a lot of them are really living in survival mode. And when you're in survival mode, sometimes you don't always make the best decisions. Mm-hmm. And I think having an understanding of that can kind of change the approach that folks have when dealing with the community.
Yeah. I was reading that Mayor Pete Buttigieg ended his presidential campaign over the weekend. And
yeah.
I'm curious about your thoughts about what his candidacy has meant to the LGBTQ community.
I think it's important for folks to be able to see representation of themselves on all levels. So, although he withdrew, I think it's important to acknowledge that someone was there, that we had representation in that place, and it can be done again.
I was going to ask you that. Do you see him sort of paving the way now?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Going forward.
Absolutely.
We talked about Amber Hikes just a few minutes ago, mm-hmm. and when she took the helm of the city's LGBT office, there was a lot of turmoil going on at that time in
yes.
the community. And one of the issues, as I understand it, was allegations of racism within the gayborhood in yes. Center City. Have things improved for people of color in that part of the city? And what do you think needs to be done there?
I think some relationships have been mended. I do think there is still work to be done. I'm sure if you ask someone else, they may have a different aspect of look on it. But I think we can always do better. Mm-hmm. I believe in working on relationship, building relationships, and moving forward, mm-hmm. And not dwelling on the past. I don't think much comes from that. But I would like to see more work done in that area. And, you know, people be more inviting and more inclusive.
Yeah. And that would seem to call for your intersectional approach that you talked
Absolutely.
About, right? Because
yes.
you've got racism, you've got, you know, just the insensitivity, you've got yeah. the multi-layered.
That's another intersectional issue that needs to be addressed, yes.
Yeah. I want to quote something that Rue Landau said about you. Rue is the executive director of the Philadelphia Commission on Human Relations, which you are also part of, and here's what Rue said about you. She is so kind and caring, and she's got a really strong passion for justice. You don't want anyone to think her kindness is weakness, because it's not. Would you care to comment on that?
I love Rue. I love Rue. No, I think I'd agree, you know. I think Rue is a pretty good judge of character, and I wouldn't disagree with anything she said.
So does that speak to a sort of speak softly and carry a big stick kind of approach?
Absolutely.
Or?
Yeah. I think it's important, no matter how heavy the message, that I think you have some concern around how you deliver that message. So, yeah.
So you've been, and I mentioned that you were part of the Philadelphia Commission on Human Relations, perhaps are still. Tell me about your involvement there and why that work has been important to you.
Well, I am no longer, because mm-hmm. I am in this position now, mm-hmm. I'm no longer on the commission. But the work that I did with commission is really important, because there I got to see a lot of the look over the discrimination claims that happened in the city. And the good part was that it wasn't only focused on the LGBT community. So I got to look at those discrimination cases and those issues concerning the city as a whole, you know, mm-hmm. and not just focus on LGBT issues. And that was, you know, issues of race, classism, disability, all of those things. So, mm-hmm. those are also things that are part of the intersection that the LGBT community goes through. So, yeah.
What did you learn about the city from that work, as you had sort of front row access mm-hmm. to some of those issues and cases that you reviewed in and out of the LGBTQ community? What did that tell you about where we are as a city as it relates to discrimination and those kinds of issues?
Well, without saying too much, I will say that the city does a great job at dealing with those issues when they come about. It's sad to see as many issues as they are, or as many claims as they are, although some of the claims are found not to be discriminatory. But I believe that the city does a great job at handling them and determining which cases need to go further. And what cases really need to be looking into.
Yeah. So from a support standpoint, as you start your new position today, in our last minute here, what will you be expecting or looking for as you begin this new position in terms of surrounding yourself with mm-hmm. people who will support you in this new role?
Well, I think I already know that I have a really great support system. Everyone has been amazing. You know, the office is a small but mighty team. I have two coordinators who have been with the office about a year, and they do an amazing job. And I'll be looking for a deputy soon. So, yeah.
Aha. Uh-huh. So you've got some work to do,
absolutely.
It sounds like, but all exciting. Selena Morrison is the new executive director of the Philadelphia Mayor's Office of LGBT Affairs. It is day one for her. She is starting her brand new job today and took the time to talk with us here at Radio Times. Selena, congratulations, and thank you so much for making time to be with us.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Radio Times on WHYY. Our producers are John Ahrens, Debbie Builder, and Kelsey Hansen. And I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Mary Cummings Jordan on the Radio Times Regional Roundup.